Welcome to another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques. I'm your host, Dustin Sutton, and today I'm honored to have as a guest Mr. Chris Campbell. He is the CEO of Simplify Automation. And Chris, welcome to the show.
Well, man, thank you for having me. You know, I've been looking forward to this conversation. You and I have been having some real deep and intense conversations about technology and what's going on. So, yeah, I'm only happy to be here and chop it up.
Yeah, so there's a lot, and we just spoke about it a little bit ago about how many different ways we could take this conversation. But before we jump into all those things, could you just briefly say a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Chris Campbell. I'm the CEO of Simplify Automation. We're an engineering company. We do things in a very unique way. We specialize in technology transfer. And a lot of people don't really know what that is, so I'll kind of dive into it for a second. Technology transfer is really about all of the advanced technologies being created by the U.S. government, all these agencies. I mean, we all know a lot of these top secret things that are being created that we always hear about. But what many people don't know is there's a law that requires that those technologies are available for commercialization. And you could take those technologies from the federal space, make a device using those technologies, and bring it to the market. A lot of the devices that we use every single day started that way. But it's like it's a trade secret that not many people know about. So what our company specializes is engineering those technologies and assisting companies who want to license those technologies from agencies like NASA or the NIH or the National Security Administration. They all have these crazy, you know, world-changing technologies that are sitting on shelves. And my company helps take those technologies off the shelf, place them with companies that can commercialize that technology, and then help those companies develop products that are innovative, that change people's lives, and that put America in a better footing. So that's that the tech transfer concept all wrapped up in a quick, you know.
So how did you, because you blew my mind when you first told me about this, how did you first become aware of technology transfer?
And that was a very interesting story. So when I started to Simplify, we were an engineering firm, but we focused on building automation. I had no idea that tech transfer existed. There's a lot that I've learned over the last 4 or 5 years that really shifted the whole perspective of the way I was looking at Simplify. So we were chugging along, putting in advanced building automation systems. And then I think it was 2019. My brother, he's a founder of the first black lead printer firm in Minnesota called Brown Venture Group. He's the one who told me about the tech transfer process. So he says, bro, there's this process called tech transfer where you can develop something as a company and go to NASA and license one of their advanced technologies. I was like, yeah, okay, that sounds crazy, but whatever. And I really didn't pay it that much mind because I hadn't seen it. So, but he had me go to this website, and it's a website that's publicly available. Anyone can go there. It's techtransfer.nasa.gov. And so I went to that website. He said, look, any technology up there, you can license and build a product with or incorporate it into something that you're already creating. And at this time, our company had made a pivot from installing building automation systems into creating building automation products. So we had already made a shift and we were already starting to create our own products. And one of those products was a automated home hospital bed controller. Just imagine the ability to be able to control a hospital bed at home if you're a quadriplegic. And so it allowed, and this is like 7 years ago before voice automation was really, you know, super popular. Everyone had it in their homes. And we created a device that would integrate with, you know, off-the-shelf home hospital bed and allow the person in that bed to have autonomy, to move their bed using voice control or other easy methods, and also tie it into their environment. So control their lights, control their door lock, their AC, all those things that you would want to be able to control in your own environment. This little box controller enabled that. So my brother came to me and said, look on this website and see if there's a sensor or something that you can use in your device. I was like, okay, bet. We were looking for a sensor. We were looking for a way to detect when the person in the bed had an accident. Because, you know, a big cause of bed sores is when the person in bed, they can't feel themselves. They don't know if they had, if they, you know, if they wet themselves or, you know, went number two. So they'll sit in it for a minute and that causes bed sores. So we were looking for a way to notify the person when they had an accident if they can't feel it. And so I went to NASA's website. I gotta say, man, like the first, I was thinking 2 weeks, I didn't know what the heck I was even reading. This stuff was just next. I was like, yo, this is bonkers. But I found a sensor and it did exactly what I was looking for. And it was something I hadn't heard of before. It's a carbon nanotube sensor. At that moment, I didn't know nothing about carbon nanotubes. I didn't know nothing about even the type of sensor I was looking at. I didn't know nothing about it. And so it led me down a path, though. You know, I looked at that sensor. I said, okay, yeah, I could use this in the bed to do what I wanted. But then I started reading about all the other applications of this sensor and how it could be used to measure disease in breath. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. You're telling me that with this sensor that NASA created, they spent tens of millions of dollars to develop it and to prove that it worked. They even did studies with like Stanford Medical and other agencies to prove it out before I licensed it. You're telling me I can take this sensor and make a device that will measure disease and breath? And the answer was yes. The bed controller was cool. But being able to diagnose disease and breath was even cooler. So being introduced to the tech transfer through a venture capital firm, it opened a door to me that allowed me to see that this thing was even possible. Now, there was a whole bunch of struggles that happened from that point. Trust me, this was not an easy journey. The story's crazy. But it would open up a process. It opened up my eyes to a process and to something that's available to everybody. That's the crazy thing. Most people don't know about this, but it's available to anyone who wants to participate. So that's how I was introduced to it. And, you know, the story of how I got to where we are now, which is we got it working. That's a whole other story. I'm not sure we have time for today, but we can try for sure.
Well, first of all, we got all the time in the world, and this doesn't have to be our last conversation or episode. But before we do that, because let's link these two together, because you're doing building controls, you're doing automated bed controls. Let's talk about your origin story. Let's talk about like how you begin. Because I know you have a background in engineering. Like, tell us a little bit about where you come from, like where you grew up, what you wanted to be when you know. How'd you see yourself as an adult when you were a kid?
Yeah, see that. Give me the whole story. So I'll start at the beginning too, because the desk I'm sitting at right now, right off the right hand side of my window, I can look about 2 miles and I see the house that I was born in. And in that house, because I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota right now, we just moved back up here. And that house is where all this actually started. That's the house that I was about 4 years old when I was first introduced to what business was and what money was and how to make it. And the crazy story is that here we are 45 years later, and I'm doing the things that started as an idea in that house when I was a tiny kid. So my background. So I was always into tech. When I was in high school, I was into audio engineering and video editing. And I went and started working at the best audio engineering schools and studios in Virginia. This is in the Hampton Roads area. This is during the time of the Neptunes, the Clips. You know, you had Timbaland, Missy, Teddy Riley. You had all the biggest producers in one, like, 10-mile radius. And that's where I came up. So once we moved from Minnesota,
how old were you when you moved from Minnesota to Virginia?
10 years old. Okay. So at 10, my father joined the military. He was an inner city minister before then. So we grew up in an all-black neighborhood called Rondo in downtown St. Paul. It's an historically black neighborhood that produced some of the greatest architects of all time, some of the greatest engineers of all time. And the block I lived on, doctors, lawyers, cops, dentists, engineers. My pops was a psychologist. But I didn't know no better. To me, that was just life. To me, you know, that's what black people were. We were doctors, lawyers, all of that. That's how Rondo was. But when you grow up in it, you don't really know what you're dealing with. So at 10, my pops joined the military. That's what took us to Virginia. And the neighborhood we moved in, was the same neighborhood that all these guys were living in. So my older brother was running with them. He first learned about making beats. And that's how I got introduced to technology. He was making beats in the studio. So at like about, say, 14 is when I really was like, damn, you know what? I like connecting equipment. I like, you know, making electronic equipment make things. It to me was the coolest thing in the world. I was that kid who would break down radios and try to figure out how to solder and try to figure out how the amp works and all that. But when I was, you know, at the end of high school, I had built up a little bit of credibility in the area. You know, we were performing, we were making beats, we were engineering. Then I got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I was just out of high school. I got an opportunity to build a major studio. It as the prior contractor. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was in the right place, the right time, with the right energy. And there was an organization called Youth Entertainment Studios. That was probably the biggest and first opportunity I had to really do something that was out of my age bracket, let's say that. And so at about, I think, 19 years old, I got an opportunity, and it was a volunteer opportunity at first. So I had to sacrifice my time to do what I got the opportunity to do. But it allowed me to learn how to build a studio, how to connect the equipment. And I was learning from the best in Virginia, how to set a room up, how to tune a room. And that knowledge base at that early age, because I dove in hard. I was reading all the books. I was learning from the masters at that time. And over a short period of time, I built a studio building company. So I'm 21 at this time, still going to engineering school. You know, I was still going to a local technology school called ECPI, which is right up there off of Virginia Beach Boulevard, if I recall correctly. And so I was going for biomedical technology. That's what I went to school for, and I really was like, yo, that's what I want to do with my life. But I was going to be a technician. I mean, you know, the guy who fixes the radiology machine, or the guy who fixes, you know, the EKG machine. That's what I intended to do. But my heart was in music. So at the same time I'm going to school for, you know, electronic engineering, I'm running a record label, I'm building studios, and I'm living that 1990s, late 90s dream. You know, we had independent labels like of Hot Boys, you know, like Master G. They was getting multi-million dollar contracts, and I was trying to do what they was doing. So that's how I got introduced to technology. Yeah, I went to school, but the school I went to, it was no Ivy League college. It's not, you know, that the degree from there don't mean nothing. You know, don't mean nothing. But it introduced me to the process. And so starting with music, you know, I built that up for a couple of years, and I actually got put out of business by the digital recording. By, you know, something called Pro Tools, where you could get a whole studio on your laptop. You don't need to hire my company. You don't need Chris. You can do all that for like $3,000 or $4,000 from, you know, the computer store. So that really, you know, it put a dent on that. But that start and me seeing how big I can get with it quick. So we went from, you know, probably making studios that cost $20,000, $30,000 tops, to like how I was 20. We were building a studio that cost $2.1 million. The mixing console alone was $1.2 million. And that was all within a short period of time. But it was because of where I was. It wasn't on me. I was constantly in the right place at the right time. But the difference is I was prepared. That's the difference. I was prepared. So boom, I get in that way. You know, I rise and I fall. You know, I had to shut the business down. I had to go get a day job. So I went into a field called home automation. It was learning, taking all the experience I had in audio video. I basically got a job that was doing audio video, but it was in building automation, the home automation. And after about 5 years doing that, I built up knowledge. I was running, you know, the company I was working for at that time was a pretty big national company. I ended up managing the company. So, you know, I was grinding. And so that led me into a whole market of home health monitoring. So, you know, in the field I was in, it was building automation, home security. And the home security part is what really brought me into healthcare monitoring at home. This is about 20 years ago. And it was alarm systems that had sensors that you could wear. So if you fall, you break your leg, it would notify your caregiver. You know, if you stay in bed all day,
I remember those commercials.
I'll fall and kick up.
That was me.
That's right.
I was installing those systems in the early 2000s when they were like unheard, like, you know, just like, how does this work? This is like the future of technology. And I was on the very top wave of that building and home automation technology. Think from its conception. Like when I first started doing this, we were putting in the very first home automation system that ever existed called X10. I installed that 25 years ago now. So even though I'm only 45, I'm a straight OG when it comes to that field. And so we went through that process. I learned so much about the concepts of home healthcare monitoring and what it does for people and how you can use technology to allow people to age gracefully in place, to allow them to prevent injuries, and when they get injuries, to get help quick. And that was what I built my career on, was really that field, introducing new technology. So every year something new comes out, cameras come out, you know, automatic door locks come out, air conditioning control, all these things start coming out. And I was that guy who was integrating, saying, oh, you can now open your garage door with this system. Okay, bet. So when you come home, your garage door opens, the lights come on, your security disarms, your AC goes, all those things are happening. And we were using that technology to keep people safe in their homes, specifically for elderly and sick people. So I did that for almost 2 decades. And, you know, I rose up the ranks. I started as a technician, I'm talking about bottom wire pulling technician. I started at that level. Mm-hmm. And I worked my way up into engineering and design. Then I worked my way up into sales. Then I worked my way up into being management. And then after a certain period of time, and during this whole time, look, I'm still a hustler. I'm always having a side business, or I'm always having a goal that was greater than my job. And so, you know, that goal for me was I was an inventor. When that house I mentioned right there, I was always doodling. I was always, you know, from an early age, always designing contraptions and just inventions. And I fancied myself a young black inventor. And then my nerd ass, I went and studied all the great black inventors, and I saw how many there were. And I saw how much impact they had on the world. I was like, yo, that's me. And I said, the other thing I did was got married early. Like right now, I did that first video at 19. That's when I got married. And I said, always tell my wife, yo, that's who I am. And not yet. I'm not that yet. But I'm that guy who's going to make those devices. And I would constantly tell her that, and I would constantly work toward that. But I still had responsibilities, and I still had to take care of home. So let's get to the chase. So what led me from that career to here was when I started my own company. It's not what from managing some of the larger companies that were in this was in Florida at this point. I started my own company to provide that same type of service, to provide monitoring at home. So we're a security monitoring company, but we're really focused on health. We're focused on delivering technologies that will allow, you know, a son to keep an eye on mom while she ages gracefully at home, or while she's recovering from illness, or when she's fallen and she's recovering and she needs that additional eye. That's what we're providing the service from. So that's why we created that bed. It tied in to the service that we were already providing. And I was like, yo, I know there's a limit to success when it comes to service. You either have to serve a whole bunch of people, or you got to provide a product that can serve a whole bunch of people. And that's kind of what led me into the desire to take my natural ability to make shit, to make things.
All good. Hey, all good. All we have to do is put a little E next to the episode and we're all good.
Using those two, my own desire to be an inventor, and knowing that I was one, not that I wanted to be one, no, I was one. I just hadn't become yet. And so I went on a journey, and that led us into patenting. It led us into probably the biggest jewel that I could drop is the USPTO Pro Bono program. That's where, look, I couldn't afford no patent when I started this. I didn't have 20 grand laid around to do a patent. But my brother, the same dude who put me on to the tech transfer, he put me on to a program that helped me fund that first patent, that helped me write that first patent. And that was probably, that's the way the explosion happened. From being introduced to that concept, going through the process, getting the patent published. And then now I actually go around and I make other people aware of it. So I became an ambassador for the pro bono program. And I make people aware that, look, if you are an inventor, it's built in us as people. We're inventors. We're creators. We're creative.
Creators, yeah.
And if you have that, you take that and you build it. And the patent, then one of the mechanisms that allows that idea to go into reality, and it goes into a business that goes to generational wealth. So, yeah, now look, that's the process.
Yeah. So, okay. You just gave a lot right there. Thank you. You gave a lot of context No, it was all needed. It was all great. But here's the thing. I want to dive into a couple of these things, because that feeling that you had, that you said, like, I'm a creator, like, I have this thing. And even though you're working on this, like, there's this need to express something. And a lot of people do it in different ways, whether it's through music, through playing music, through experiencing music, whether it's dance, whether it's, you know, public speech, whatever, art, pottery, whatever. It's like there's that need to create. Everyone's a consumer, but there's a need to create. And I feel like, you know, and the things that we do, even this podcast and, you know, what I'm doing with Ranges, I have never felt more alive than when I'm doing these things, when I'm meeting great people such as yourselves and like such as the things that you've learned on your journey that you've helped share with me. And we're going to go more into the USPTO, even though it felt like maybe it felt like such a grind on your end, you know, that you'd had to go through all this. Like, there's so much value in that. All the things that you've learned through all the products that you through tech transfer, through the all of those things. And you've told me, and I'm like, what? How have I never heard of this? How have I never seen this? And it's just amazing, all the things that you've been able to share. So thank you for sharing your journey and all those things and those gems.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me about it, because this conversation is like this. No, this conversation, how about that? Not conversations like this. This conversation is how we start to get the word out for this process, because there's countless thousands of people just like me and you that have this. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a need to do this. It's not that we want to do this. It's built in. It's a need to create. It's something that's inside that has to get out. And depression is when you keep that thing in. Freedom and joy is when you pursue that thing that's inside you. And invention is the greatest act of pursuing what's inside of you, because you're taking a thought, something that doesn't exist, and you're giving it existence. And I, you know, I don't push religion or belief on anyone's throat, but I'll say that if you see God as a creator, then the greatest act of worship, the greatest act of becoming like who created you, is creating. An invention is just a different word for creation. You can invent anything. You can invent music. You can invent this. There's a whole world of invention that opened up to me through this process. And what I found is that joy is the best word I like to use. The struggle is a joy. Because trust me, there's many days where I'm terrified. I've risked the farm. I've risked everything in this pursuit. But the joy, that's what you can bring with you when you go, right? I can't bring none of the money. I can't bring a car. But what I can bring with me is the joy. The thing that I'm going to have the last moment is going to be like, dang, how do I live my life? And if I can say to myself, yeah, man, I chased that. Every moment that I had, put into it, I went hard. And that's, to me, that's the joy. So, you know, I'm pursuing what you're pursuing is really that sense of joy, that sense of freedom. And we're doing it through our invention. So you hit it right in the head, man, because that's, mm-hmm. You ask what's the purpose of the life. Man, it's the experience, dog. It's what you're doing with your time. That's the purpose. I've chosen, I see you chose the same thing. You've chosen to create with your time. You got bills to pay and you got a family to take care of. But you're bringing something that didn't exist and you're giving it existence, bro. If that's not godly, tell me what is.
Man, you know what? And the process of finding where you tap into that joy, that's a part of the process too, because sometimes you won't know. Sometimes you know, you can talk to people that think it's with, you know, buying this car or buying this. And it's like, oh, wow, there was nothing there, you know? into something. There's little sparks of happiness, but is it that joy? Like, many times it's not. But you're right. Like, the act of creation, the act of invention, and one thing I've learned is connection. And it's having these conversations, having this conversation, bringing people together, lifting people up. And by sharing our experiences, by sharing the things that you know, there's somebody that's going to be listening to this that says, oh, wow, I've had this idea that I've always wanted to do. Maybe this is a good resource for me to get this to the next level.
Look, Matthew, look, you never had. So I've everything. The most important thing that I did with this journey was building the team. So what does that actually mean, though? It's relationships. So that if you break down with this whole process, you know, commercialization, building a business, inventing your product, bringing it to market, all of that rests on relationship. The biggest challenge that I had of taking this license from NASA, when I started this, I only had two people on my team. And these are guys who did building automation. They didn't do chemically resistant sensors or carbon nanotube sensors. We didn't even know what a carbon nanotube was. And so we knew, look, if we're going to do this, and we're going to do it right, because you know, one thing I am is I'm a great project manager. I execute with excellence. So I knew if I take the project on, we can build the team. And if we build the team and we execute with excellence, the result's going to be what we want. And so that really, the scariest thing that I had to do was build a team from scratch. And we're talking about, I needed chemists, I needed engineers, I needed scientists, I needed fabricators, a manufacturer. And I didn't know where to look. I didn't have a single friend in any of those markets. I couldn't call a single guy and be like, yo, you graduated with, you know, a degree in so-and-so, come work with me for free for 6 months. No one's answering that call, dude. No one's coming to work for no one for free in these days and age. So the challenge is, how do I build the team necessary to do this crazy task with no money, with no connections, for straight, raw scratch? And I'll tell you how I did it. One relationship at a time. This is how you did it. I build value before you extract value. I had to do a lot of service. I had to prove myself a lot in different points. I had to show consistency. If I said I was going to do something, I had to do it. And I had to do it well. And over time, people begin to give you equity. That means, you know, you help me with this process, I'll help you with now, I'll help you with that. And that exchange, that building of relationships and that constantly demonstrating character, that's what it was. In order for me to build a team, I had to constantly demonstrate character. And through building that team, that's the only way that I'm able to sit with you right now and have swag like, yo, we got something that's going to change the world. It's not because of I did it, because, yeah, I got capabilities, but it's the team that's behind me. When I shine, I'm reflecting their light. And then that's the most important thing, is that team that you need to build, we're talking more than just your friends and your people that automatically believe in you. We're talking about convincing people who don't know you from Tuesday to believe in what you're doing, and then to invest in what you're doing. First, invest their time, listen to you, you know, process it, give you advice, and then maybe join, do some work. All those things require relationship, man. But the thing is, that's where the value is. In business, the value is in relationships. At home, the value is in the relationship. So you know, everything you're doing, if you keep that first, you keep it A1 with everyone you're dealing with. That's the money strategy. And so you hit it on point, that chasing that joy is really chasing relationships. Chasing my dream requires me to network with people, to have conversations that we're having right now, to learn from people like you, to learn from people like Jim Patterson, who started the Patent Office Pro Bono Program, to learn from people like Jerome Hamilton, who started, co-founded Brown Venture Group, and really put me and my brother on to game. To see, not telling you why I'm in it. All I'm doing is saying things that people showed me. The difference is, when someone told me it, I just didn't go one in and out the other. I just meant acting on it the next day. But yeah, man. So it's also relationships, bro.
Well, look, speaking of relationships, and you just touched on the relationship with the person who created the pro bono for the Patent Trade Office. Let's talk about that system or that process. Can you like just lay it out there? Like what is this? When did it start? Who's behind it? And why is it important?
So it all starts with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. That's the agency in the government that protects invention. It guarantees that the invention you've made is unique and is commercializable, and you get protections. Now, there's give or take there. So it's, you know, nothing comes without strings attached. But the patent process is necessary for making money off of inventions and protecting your invention. So what prevents most inventors from actually making something is that it's incredibly difficult to get a patent. It's incredibly difficult to invent something in the first place. But then the costs that come along with doing a patent, they start at around $20,000. And they could go as much as $60,000 without batting an eye. It's because you're dealing with a lawyer who charges $450 to $600 an hour. And they charge you that whether they're talking with you or they're reading something about your thing or they're, you know, reviewing or they're looking up prior patents. All that costs money. And so what prevents most people from actually pursuing that dream is the fear of the price tag. And that's if you even get far along enough to find that it's so expensive. And most people don't even get there. But once you find, like, whoa, in order for me to invent this, I've got to come out of the pocket for $25,000, it's extremely difficult. Now, who is it the most difficult for? It's most difficult for the people who don't have that money laying around. And those people are often minorities, economically disenfranchised. Because guess what? It ain't just black and brown people that are struggling. It ain't just black and brown people that are economically disenfranchised and don't have opportunities and don't have friends and family that can invest. Those things don't exist for most people. So then how does most people who have, everyone has invention in them, everybody. So if very, very few people can afford to do it, guess what? Very, very few people control the whole thing. So the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for years has been how money is made for product. But about 20 years ago, a great man named Jim Patterson, he recognized a need. He recognized that there were brilliant people coming to him with brilliant ideas that would advance humanity, but they couldn't afford him. A lot of these people were black and brown men and women. And so over and over again, he saw that story replay. A brilliant inventor who has the capabilities, they have the knowledge, but they don't have the funding. And he said he realized that most of the inventions that were being created by the population were never seen light of day. Imagine how many benefits to mankind are being lost because of that financial barrier. So he created a program called the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office Pro Bono Program. Pro bono means you give back for the good, the greater good. And so a pro bono is usually when a lawyer represents someone who can't afford them. It's usually for, like, you know, a family case where, you know, or a divorce or a criminal case where the person can't afford to hire a good lawyer. There's lots of reasons why people need lawyers and they can't afford it. And pro bono is a way that a lawyer can give back his time to the community by volunteering to help someone in need of legal support. And so Jim took that concept of pro bono work and he applied it to the patent office. And he went out and found a group of lawyers who would be willing to volunteer their time to help inventors who couldn't afford their service. So Jim partnered with the Patent and Trademark Office to say, look, let's allow lawyers all over the U.S. to volunteer their time on behalf of the Patent and Trademark Office and give that time to deserving and capable people who can't afford it. And so he created the USPTO Pro Bono Program. And over the 20 years, he gained more and more lawyers to the program. He increased which states offer the program. Whereas today, if you're an inventor, you're no more than probably a couple of hours away from a pro bono lawyer who will take your case, if you get, of course, there's a certain income threshold. But what did I tell you? Pretty much everyone can apply for this. The income threshold, you got to be rich before you don't qualify for this. So what I'm telling you about, every single person who's listening to this has the immediate capability to act on it. If you're an inventor, the pro bono program is available to you. And I'll tell you what happened with me, because look, there's no difference between me and everyone who would be listening to this. So I was introduced the same way. I had it in my heart, but I had given it up. I was like, yo, I can't afford that. That's what I told my brother when he told me to pursue this. I was like, yeah, bro, I don't have the money for that. So he introduced me, and it was just by divine intervention that I was introduced to Jim. So my introduction to the pro bono program just happened to be with the guy who made it. Yeah. And at this point in life, he's nearing retirement. He's trying to preserve his legacy. He's like, look, man, I've built this thing. I've built this tool, but now I need people to know about it. Because most people, no one really knows about this thing. There's not outreach programs. There's not block parties. These things stay undercover. And that's what we're trying to undo now. So he basically introduced me to this concept. Look, you have to do the work for the pro bono program. So they don't write the patent for you. They help you write the patent. And they cover the costs that usually prevent someone from writing it. So the way it works is that if you get assigned a pro bono lawyer, they're basically going to volunteer all their time. And that could equal about $15,000, $20,000. They're going to volunteer that time because they believe in you. They believe that them putting that time into you benefits them and the entire community. That's the definition of pro bono. So then you get time with that lawyer. And I'll tell you what Jim did to me. He taught me. He taught me how to read a patent. You can look at the document, but you really don't know what you're reading. It becomes googly. It becomes like 1,000 words on a page. None of that makes sense. The first thing he did was take time. That's the most valuable thing that Jim gave me. There's never going to be a value that I could place on the countless hundreds of hours that he spent with me. But I made him a promise, though. I said, Jim, if you spend this time with me, your legacy will get a return on the investment. I'm going to tell everybody about this. Mm. I'm going to teach every person that I can about this program. And just wait. There's so many inventors who are going to get an opportunity to bring something to market. There's so many advances that all humanity will be able to benefit from because of the work you did and the opportunity you're providing me. So he sat there and taught me how to read a patent. Then he taught me how to write the patent. He taught me what a claim was. He taught me how to build the body of the patent, how to focus so that it passes inspection. And he did that over about, let's say, a 3 or 4 month period. And that was an experience I'll never forget because everything was new. I was being introduced to ideas I had never seen before. And I was understanding it because this dude, this guru, was teaching me. And so at the end of that process, man, hold up. I get teary because this changed everything. This changed everything, bro. At the end of this process, I wrote what I thought was like opus. It was magnificent. I did all this research and I was building on what NASA did. So I wasn't starting from scratch. I was innovating what I had already licensed from NASA. Because see, patenting is about innovation. So if you start with a sensor like I did with the carbon nanotube resistor that can detect gases, and then I built out of it a device that can diagnose disease, and I patented the device because it's about innovation. So when I wrote that patent, I had no idea whether Jim was going to be like, yo, this is trash. Like, I'm going to need to rewrite the whole thing. But this is what I didn't realize, that every conversation he was having with me, he was schooling me. He was showing me how to write the patent. And he did such a stellar job that when I submitted the patent to him, and that moment was bonkers. So I was like, yo, I've written my first patent. And now there's multiple steps to a patent. And I'm talking about the final step. I'm talking about the non-provisional patent that is registered, that protects you. When I pushed that to him, this is after like a year and a half of work on developing this patent. He read it and I had butterflies in my stomach. I was like, man, is this guy gonna be like garbage?
He called me. He was like, Chris, of my entire career, you were the first person who wrote an entire patent on his own that I can just push through the patent office.
Right.
I was like, stop playing, bro. Stop. It was good? He was like, it was excellent. And in that moment, I knew something. And I told him, I was like, this means you was an excellent teacher. Because not put out in that document is what you put into me. You put into me an understanding. And I took that understanding that there's no way I would have been able to write that document if it wasn't for that time. So what that pro bono process did is it took me by the hand. I had no previous experience. None at all when it comes to, you know, patenting. And he took me through a process and put me, the best way to put me on the game. He said, this is how you protect the patent. This is how you do it. And here's the pro bono program that will allow you to spread the message about it. Bring people into it. Engage the inventors who are all there. Everyone you speak with. There's going to be so many people that hear this that was like, yo, that's me. I'm that inventor. Yeah, you are. You are. So the next step is do it. Act on it. And the first thing you can do is reach out to the pro bono program. We'll put a link to the pro bono.
I'll put a link to that and also the tech transfer in the show notes. So I'll include that in all this. Yeah.
Yes. And just understand, when people go look at these two things, I want you really to really, really understand this. This is something you can do right now. You do not have to have any particular thing. There's no degree that you need to have. There's no amount of money that you need to have. There's no excuse that you're going to be able to give yourself. That's real. Because I'll tell you, the pro bono program, if you're the individual, you have to make below around $60,000, I believe. It's around that mark. If you're a family of four, I think it's 200 and change that your household can bring in. And you still apply. Forgive me if that number is wrong. It's four times the national poverty level that you can make an income and still qualify for this program. In essence, get 99% of that cost of patenting taken care of. What I had to pay for was the filing fee, which, you know, $200, I think $400. Mm-hmm. I had to pay for like a registration, a couple hundred bucks. I think total. That all the fees that I paid was around $1,200 as opposed to $20,000.
You know, I think you touched on something about where do you start? And that for me with ranges, with the glasses, golf glasses, still weird when I say that, golf glasses, when came, I was like, I don't know where to start. Like, but I knew I had that thing that I was like, I got to do something with this. And I didn't know where to go. And it's funny, like when the student's ready, the master appears and, that kept happening along the way. When I filed for my provisional, it was like then I met somebody who's like, oh, well, you may want to do this and that. And it's like, well, now I need an entity. And I was like, oh, I'll talk to this person. You know, you can do that. And so then kept happening. Like, I kept meeting the right person. And then it took some time to develop those relationships. But now here I am, like, a year past, has gone since I originally filed the provisional. And then meeting you and seeing all these resources, it's like, oh my gosh. But I almost feel like if I would have known some of these resources and some of these things before, it may have seemed a little overwhelming at first. But
yeah, 100%.
Yeah, because there's a lot. Even with these resources, you know, you go to the tech transfer page and you're like, you see space shuttles and stuff. And you're like, okay, wait a minute. Maybe I'm in the wrong place. But it's like, but I would say anybody who's listening to this that has an idea or has something, you know, I'm not inventhelp.com or, you know, ip.com or any of those things.
None of those guys. Nope.
But it's like, if there's a way that I can help shorten that curve for people and either direct them to you or Jim Patterson or whomever, it's so valuable to be able to somebody to just, you know, not give you a shortcut, but at least point you in the right direction. So you're not being so overwhelmed to the point where you give up or you think it's fruitless.
Yeah.
You know, like there's people that are out there that are willing to help you get to where you want to go.
Well, you're bringing some crazy good points, Matt, because that you brought up a couple of things that were actually my biggest challenges. Being overwhelmed. The sense of imposter syndrome. Dude, what business do I have commercializing and advanced technology from NASA. None. None. Yeah. When I made the, you got to say, you're meeting the version of me now. But you got to understand, there was a version of me 6 years ago that had no experience in this. And that everyone would be like, why in the world would you risk so much to go down that? Because I had some great advisors told me it's stupid. I had great advisors tell me, yeah, you can do it, but you're going to give up 10 years of your life. Are you willing to do that? Look how old your kids are. Are you going to do that? You're going to risk the next 10 years of your life and it could or could not work? And I had to be able to answer my, I had to ask myself that question, like, man, am I? And the overwhelmness, like I told you, when I first looked at the website with NASA, I was completely overwhelmed. And I had a history in electronics. So I had a fundamental understanding. It's very overwhelming. So there's two things that you're going to face. You're going to be overwhelmed and you're going to have imposter syndrome. The best advice I can give is the advice I gave myself, get over it. This is what's going to happen. You're going to start feeling that way. It's just a feeling. But every single day that you get up early and you grind out and you learn, every single day you become closer and closer and closer to the person that you want to be. There was a moment, I remember this moment. There was a moment where I said, I'm no longer the imposter. All this time I've been having this like, oh man, all these, you know, all these PhDs and all, you know, all these people around me and I'm the dumbest guy in the room. But then there came a time where I was like, oh no, I've done my homework. I've built myself into that guy. I've built myself into the guy that I wanted to be, but I didn't start that way. And there was like a 3-year period where that was heavy on my chest. Like, dang, man, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. I've risked all this, and I don't know whether this sensor is going to work, because there was a long time in this process where it was theoretical, and I was having to make risks based upon something that might work, but I had never made work myself. So there was enormous, enormous fear. That was the biggest thing I had to get over in order to do this. It was raw fear. Fear of failure, fear of embarrassment, fear of being called out, you know, like, what are your credentials? Man, I got nothing that y'all don't care about. No one cares about EZPI. That, you know, no one cares about that stuff. So that overwhelmingness, it has an opposite, and the opposite is joy. Mm. So I found that if I got through that fear, it is a wave. Just trust me, the fear, I mean, even now, I'm not going to front and be like, no, this is still a terrifying exercise. I'm still risking an enormous, at this point, is new, like, I'm at that point where I've risked it all and now I'm getting the benefit. But yeah, it was the terror of getting here. So, but what do you get around that? So you open up another issue that I had to discover for myself and I had to solve for myself. But in the act of doing that, I decided to solve it for other people. So this is what happened. My weight license is a sensor from NASA. I'm a carbon nanotube gas sensor. And I asked him, I said, okay, bet, I've licensed it from you now. Now, can you hook me up with the company who can help me make it? And they were like, that's you. You have to make it. There's no prototype we're going to give you. You have to make this from scratch. I thought y'all was going to give me a sensor and I was going to connect it to an electronics board and wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Nah, that's not the way it works. You have to have the capabilities, but it's not that you yourself have the capabilities. You have to build the team that has the capabilities. So that took a process. But what I discovered is that there's a huge need for those teams to be pre-built. And the resources, like, who's going to build this part? Who's going to build the sensor? Who's going to build the electronics? Who's going to write the software? Who is going to testing validated? Who knew about the medical piece? I'm not a doctor by trade. I can read a report. We needed all those expertise. And when I went to NASA, they made it very clear. We don't provide those. I said, okay, well, you don't provide those. Well, who do y'all go to make y'all's, like, Dell stuff? And when I found out, the government is like a million cells in a beehive. And none of them have anything to do with each other. They don't know nothing about what each other are doing. They don't share resources. They don't say, look, I got a good sensor guy. Oh, who, me? I got a good machining guy. They don't do that. So when you engage with them, you're often by yourself. So what I did with Simplify was build a company that will provide that path. So instead of you coming and saying, I have to go find an engineer, find a chemist, find where to manufacture, find where to test it, we compile those resources. So an inventor can go to one place and find an appropriate engineer for his project, an appropriate manufacturing partner, so who's going to build the prototype, and then also get information on grants, get information on where you can fund the project while you're developing it. What I needed when I started this was I needed a one-stop shop, and not something like Invent Help where they charge you to help you look at an idea. No, I needed someone who could help me build the thing that I want to build. And I recognized a hole. The hole is there needs to be a service for that. There needs to be somewhere where an inventor could go and say, here's my idea. You know, I've gotten the patent. You know, we try to deal with companies who are either have a early patent, which is a provisional, and they're working on that final or non-provisional patent. We provide the electrical resources, the engineering, the chemistry, whatever is needed for that project. And that's really, I think, is the fuel that's needed for a lot of these aspiring inventors. Because it's great to have an idea, but there's a big gap between an idea and a thing. And not just my company. I'm discovering more companies that have the desire to do this, have a capability, but there needs to be a connection. That relationship thing you talked about. There needs to be a connection between the people and the process. And that's what both myself, you know, as the CEO of Simplify, my brother, Dr. Paul Campbell, and Brown Venture Group, and a whole ecosystem of companies that are working to provide this service. And we deal with, there's an organization called the Federal Laboratory Consortium. Now, that's another jewel that you definitely want to pay attention to. Because all these things I'm saying play together. It's all part of a circle. It's the circle of development. And the FLC is, again, an agency that no one ever hears about. You hear about, you know, the FBI. You hear about all those three-letter agencies, but you don't ever hear about FLC because no one cares about FLC. But FLC has more to do with your life than any other agency in the whole world. The Federal Laboratory Consortium. It's all any federal agency. And this is another rule I'm going to drop on you. Right? It's a law. Any federal agency that gets money from the public of over $300 billion is legally mandated to have a technology transfer office. And there's a law that mandates that they have to make these technologies available to the public for commercialization. Now, they have some rules around it. There's stipulations, there always is, but it's a law. It's our right as citizens to license those technologies from any one of those 300 labs. And the FLC is an organization that governs those labs and ensures that they're transferring technology to U.S.-based companies to make the product in the U.S. by U.S. workers, and they have to. But the challenge is most people don't know about it. Very, very few companies know about this. The companies that we consult and introduce this to, it's a gold mine to them. But they've never heard of it before. They don't know how to interact with these federal agencies. So the FLC, my brother and Simplify, we serve the FLC and we serve all 300 labs. And the way that we serve them is that A, we bring awareness. We introduce companies to the process. We introduce young entrepreneurs and we focus on all different demographics, but we start where there is the greatest amount of untapped talent. And that's in two demographics. Now we're disenfranchised, meaning you don't have the financial capability to do what your idea is. And that's probably got 80% of Americans, if truth is told. The other is black and brown and socially disenfranchised groups that have been purposely blocked out of a lot of these resources and purposely not made aware. Because once you equip someone with these resources, you've unleashed a whole different path for that person. You've unleashed a whole different freedom for that person. But the thing is, that's beautiful. That person goes out and creates jobs. that person goes on and creates wealth, not just for themselves, but for the community around them, for their family. And that's what this process enables. So the place to start with me, I started because my brother told me about it. Just does this brother to brother. Like, look, this is what I found. And he didn't invent things. So he couldn't take advantage of it. But he was like, bro, you invent things. You always have. You need to do this. And I had the same fear that everyone who hears this have. I was like, yo, I got bills to pay, bro. I don't got time to throw at something like that. That's what young kids do when they ain't got nothing to risk. I got kids who are going to college, man. I don't got time for all that. But you know what? If I wouldn't have made that terrifying first move, I wouldn't have had the second move. I wouldn't have met Jim Patterson from the Pro Bono program. I wouldn't have met Harvey Chavez from NASA Tech Transfer and all these wonderful people and relationships that have brought this joy into my life, because this process is a lot of joy. These wouldn't have happened if I let fear be the main contributing factor. So we're gonna drop resources at the end of this on places they can start. Yes, they can call me. It's not, it won't just end with me. There's resources like FedTech. There's lots of resources that, depending on what stage that person is in their journey, there's a place I can say, okay, at this stage in your journey, start here. Go call this guy.
Well, and that's, we'll give them the resources. We'll give them the list. But I just know that this is just the end of part one of this conversation. There's so much more to explain and to that I want to learn personally, but so much that you already know that sometimes it may just seem like it's offhand or like, oh yeah, I forgot that I even knew that, because it's once you see behind the curtain and demystify a lot of this stuff, it really is so much more accessible and achievable.
You know what? This is actually is a great time, because there's some opportunities coming down the pipe for people who are interested in this to take immediate action. And there's something called the NASA Inclusive Mashup Lab. Hmm. It's where NASA brings some of these technologies from this website, and they first find a buyer for it. That's the crazy thing. They first find a big company like Medtronic or Johnson & Johnson to be a buyer for the technology. And then that entrepreneur gets introduced to the technology. They get an entire team of engineers from companies like Summit, PTX, all these big NASA contractors. And they get the ability to develop that product in like a boot camp style program. Mm. And they're going to be holding these events all over the U.S. So this is a unique opportunity in time where people who have had this desire built in them from childhood or from young adulthood, from however it's been there, there's an opportunity that didn't exist before. Last year was the first Inclusive Mashup Lab, and they took Black and brown and economically disenfranchised people, pair them with engineers with experience, pair them with technology. And out of that first round, there were six groups that went in. Five of them walked away with licenses.
Wow.
That's five new companies. That's five new generational wealth generating opportunities. And that's what we're trying to expand on. So this is the time, brother.
All right.
What I would love to do is, we have these conversations and we talk about the step-by-step that you can take to actually make this happen. So they don't just hear it, they can act on it.
Well, you know, you've been very generous with your time today. This is just part one. There's so much more to go. So, Chris, thank you so much for today. This is great. This is a great conversation. I can't wait to go back and listen to this and pull out those things, because some of them that I've already been working on, but you've introduced some new things today that I'm like, oh man, maybe you did talk about that before, but it just spilled out of my cup. But this has been great. Thank you, sir.
And this is great because, you know, I'm usually with my head down in the lab. Being able to talk to people like you and start getting this information out, that's what my passion is. So I appreciate you, my brother, for having me on this. And there's going to be some people who get this opportunity just because of what you're doing, man. So I appreciate you.
Oh, man. Well, it's a joy. I really enjoy this. All right, man. Thanks, Chris.
Bye. Peace.